You know, he's really shameless in intellectual argument. He's absolutely without character, a moral foundation, or even intellectual substance.
All right, welcome back to the Getting Lit podcast. Last week, we talked about the 20 Days of Turin. Really fun episode. Go back and look at that if you haven't already. This week, I am joined for the final chapter of our read-along of Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun. And I'm joined once more by my favorite crazy-ass white boys, J. David Osborne and Kelby Lozak. How you going?
Hello.
We are now at the end, the final volume, which is called The Citadel of the Ortark. What to say about this book, first up? Let's talk more about the journey, like in broad strokes first. Like, how was it for you guys? Start with you, Kelby, because you'd never read it before.
Oh, incredible. This has been like up and down. It makes me even more trepidatious to get into any other kind of like fantasy shit because I've never really been able to get into fantasy shit. And I feel like none of it's going to be like this. So now I'm like, no. But having no idea what to expect outside of several people I trust saying, oh, this series is like one of the best. Like Book of the New Sun slaps so hard. Besides that, having no idea what I'm getting into, all of the like, it's got all the like agitatorisms, the shit that we fuck with constantly, the tonal shifts, the like just not compromising, you know, understanding or expectation for whatever, just being like, nope, I'm gonna do this, and then dropping your nuts on the table and going for it. So many payoffs, like payoff after payoff. It's been a long time since I've read something like that, that sets something up and doesn't go in some obscure, weird, like abstract direction. It is just like, oh, the green man and the tent. Yeah, we'll get back to that later. It's like, oh, holy shit. Like, which David lied to me. You said the green man don't show up again.
Yeah, I lied. I'm sorry about that. Although in my defense, I wasn't lying. It's just that the green man only shows up for like a paragraph and I forgot. So
oh, I didn't intentionally lie to you. Oh my God. The amount of shit jam-packed into Citadel is only 300 pages.
Yeah. It's technically shorter than the first one, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The longest is Conciliator, and then the rest are about the same.
Mm. And see, Conciliator feels the shortest. Mm. Like the way that this series just expands and contracts like fucks with time. It's like you're reading while somebody's holding the claw up to you, like fucking with the time and everything.
Mm-hmm. And David, how was it for you reading the whole thing again?
Really good. I was reading it much more for the stories this time around. So the first time that I read it, I was still being like plot brain about it, you know, and I was like, okay, where does it go? And I remember the first time I read Citadel of the Autar feeling like that it was a slog, that book was a slog because it's so story heavy. Mm-hmm. And this time, sort of knowing more what I was getting into, I was like, you got to really sink into these. The tales aren't like distractions, because normally when people do stuff like this, they're padding out a book, they're trying to make it a little bit longer. And the Book of the New Sun as a whole is a book about storytelling. Mm-hmm. That's literally what it is. It's not a hero's journey. In fact, like at the end, when he becomes the Autark, this time around, it was so hilarious to me that it's an afterthought in the book. You know, it's the last 30 pages or whatever. And he's just like, oh yeah. And then I did this. And then there's this kind of hilarious Lord of the Rings style, like Kelby was saying, wrapping up of all these different threads. And oh yeah, by the way, Owen was Dorcas's son. And isn't it weird that Owen and Severian look a lot alike? Mm-hmm. There might be something going on with that.
With the letter, then, like the waiter guy who had the letters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So if you are thinking, because the first half of Citadel is just this bleak sick house where everybody's dying because he's in the middle of this war and they're just telling each other stories. Again, if you go into this thinking that the last book is going to be, it's the war book, right? So you're going to get all this cool war. There's one battle chapter. One.
Yeah. And the way, it's good, but the way that that's rendered is not how it's typically rendered in like your standard fantasy novel, which it'd be like five chapters. It'd be like, you know, almost like a symphony of battles. That's what a lot of fantasy authors do, where like there's the opening movements and like twists and turns and stuff like that. This one is more just sort of like, there's a little bit of like strategizing and things like that, but it's mostly just sort of like flashes of battle and like flashes of weirdness about what's involved in the battle too. Like there's energy weapons, then there's fellas with swords. And then like one of the things that happens kind of before the battles is when he teams up with this, I forget what they're called, but they're like a mercenary kind of group. And he has to tame his mount. And this goes back to something that a question that I had when I first read the first volume, which is, you know, Gene Wolfe talking about mounts and stuff like that, calling them destriers or things like that, which are synonyms for different kinds of horses, but they're clearly not horses. Like they have fangs and shit like that. And like part of the, I guess, alchemy of the book is that he's rendering this into understandable kind of language. And then you get more of a sense of that, like of the details being like alien, but he's rendering them in a sort of way that we can understand in our world now. And that kind of gives this really weird sort of estrangement effect or something that makes the battles, it's not like a play-by-play, this happened and that happens. It's just more like, I guess, what you would experience in a battle, like flashes of this and that. And that's, I found that really great and very, it's suggestive, but also really evocative at the same time, like without going into like the slog of your Brandon Sanderson kind of like.
The size of the horse's dick and
and the battle really was joined.
I really liked the Asians mounts. That shit cracked
the Asians. Well,
what they're called.
Ascians.
I'm supposed to know how to pronounce that shit.
They're not Asians, although some people would say they are, that's why they're problematic. But I didn't really get that at all. I didn't think they were Asians, but
I didn't. I thought they were called Asians, but I didn't think they were like Asians. The Ascians, they're like dwarves that ride taller dudes.
That reminds me of
there's like one sentence too of like they talk about these butterfly women that come down and like have lasers. It's little details like that where you're thinking this is some kind of bizarre shit. Like there are these pinwheel ships that are flying around and
biblically accurate angels.
Biblically accurate angels. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's super fucking tight. And the Ascians to me were, I think, the most if you want to call them monsters, like the scariest monsters in the whole book. But I guess we could talk about that later if you want.
That might be some subconscious shit with the
Asians. Calling them Asians. Mongol hordes. You guys have a pro-Asian podcast, so you know you can't be accused of racism.
Yeah, we absolutely we can, we have, and we will continue to do so.
Yeah.
And
you want to start Asian hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want to pick it up a little bit, you know, because we're
I'm spiritually black, so you know.
And you know there's a ever since Menace to Society, there's been that rift between those two communities.
So, that movie is what started it.
That's what happened. Before that, it was all beautiful. It's like a love-hate thing though, because the way that I always bond with Black people is by talking about anime. Straight up, like, you meet a Black dude and you say, hey, do you watch One Piece? They'll be like, yes. And then you have instant friends.
Well, that's interesting, because I don't know if not, I don't think recall you guys ever speaking about this on your podcast, Agitator, by the way, go and listen to it if you haven't. But there's something about anime that is like, the way that people are depicted is very racially, unless they're depicting a Black person, everyone is very racially ambiguous. Like, so,
you know why that is?
What?
You know why that is? Because anime characters are actually supposed to look like cats, not people. They're modeled after cats. I think it was Tezuka or whatever, when he was inventing that big-eyed anime style, he was using the proportions of cats because he wanted it to be like a human cat person.
Interesting. So I didn't know that. Is that true? Or are you bullshitting?
It's true. No, it's true. I'm not making that up. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they're supposed to be cat-like. Which is why you have cat girls, right? Like, that's the natural outgrowth of that, is real life human being women who wear cat ears and stuff like that, and who are also really into anime.
Yeah.
I don't know if they know that, but that's why.
Yeah. So you'll get like Japanese people and characters in anime who are like from England, and they, everyone looks the same, and Japanese people with blonde hair and shit like that in anime.
And then Black people with big old watermelon lips.
You know? What's his name? Mr. Popo from Dragon Ball Z.
Mr. Popo, yeah. Big old, just the worst racial caricature you can imagine of a Black person.
As every Black friend who has had to defend Dragon Ball against their mom has told me, Mr. Popo is not even a person.
How what he is can't, he?
I don't, like a genie god or whatever.
Oh, okay.
He's alien. I don't know. But yeah, I've heard that so many times.
Oh, my
Whether
goodness.
I bring it up or somebody else, they're like, Mr. Popo isn't even a person. Because so many, I know so many Black kids, they get told, you're not watching this shit no more because they see Mr. Popo. And they're like, oh, hell no. Not in my house.
Yeah, dude. No, I get it. I get it. But they're kind of right. But also it's definitely supposed to be a Black person, because you can see that in like every old anime. And it really is, like what Matt said is totally true. Everybody looks the same until you get to Black people. And yet, and this is why it's such a racially beautiful thing, Black people love it. Mm. And they have to know what they're looking at. But for the most part, they either look past it or they're just like, you know, yeah, that sucks, but whatever. I still like it. So it's beautiful. I love that Black people love anime.
Where were we talking? We were talking about Askians.
Yes.
they were really interesting, I think, because in the Citadel of the Ortak, you get a little bit more information on them, a little bit more of fleshing out of the war that, you know, the Commonwealth is against these people, and the way that they think, their philosophy, which I found really interesting. I was going to save this for later, but as long as we're talking about it now, this idea of correct thought, and like people often, I think part of the reason why people have a problem with the Askians, I think I mentioned it a couple of episodes ago when I was mentioning some recap that someone did on tor.com, where they were like, I seem to remember the Askians being problematic. And so I'm looking at this, reading the tea leaves and being like, what could they find problematic about this? And I think what they're doing is they're reading Gene Wolfe's biography into his depiction of this society, mm-hmm. because he's I think it was Korean War he fought in.
Yeah.
So it's like he's depicting these communists as like, they all think the same. They all like speak basically in the same kind of rote language. They all look the same. And they have this kind of, the way it's depicted is often talked about like it's communism, like Maoism or something. But I don't know. It seems like I kept getting, you know, libtards basically, because it's like people speaking in like axioms, not actually thinking. And
pre-approved
so,
axioms, yeah.
Yeah, the way that they kind of communicate their ideas is through ideas that are vetted through this council of 17 or whatever the fuck it's called. And that is the only way they can communicate. And it's just like, this is like people online, like people just like speaking in slogans, like yes. or variations on things like that. And like, that was very kind of, I don't know. It just rang true to the current era with me. None of these people are individuals. They just, the speaking in those kind of pre-approved sentences that are always exactly the same was like really prescient and scary to me. He's doing his Orwellian thing with that, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And then when he's got Shorty, I don't remember who was translating for him, but like,
Foyla.
She's, yeah, yeah. And they're going back and forth. It's all that dialogue of like the axiom. And then she's like, he went and got beat again. And then the mm-hmm. return to a warm bed. Oh yeah, he went home. And then like, and Severian goes, how the fuck you just do that? Like you can understand this person.
No, that shit tripped me out. It was, and I thought it was so genius on so many levels because, first of all, what it got me thinking about was our language in general. The fact that these people could speak in pre-approved axioms, but the kind of the way that they structured them, the order that the axioms were structured, created stories in a language that you could understand anyway. I started thinking like, holy shit, if you pull that thread, how is it that we talk? We all kind of do that. And I agree with Matt 100% that is libtard speak. That's just reality right now. If you turn on Twitter, you see it.
Very,
but
online
it got me thinking
speak too.
It's very online speak. It's, you know, I like, see, go ahead.
I just, when I see anybody, it's a certain, you know, being detached. I've had so much shit going on in the past few weeks that like Israel Palestine been a big thing that like, just, I feel like within 3 weeks, I have no idea what the language is, and people yeah, send shit neither. And I'm like, yeah. What is being said? I don't even, not even what is yeah. their stance? What is their opinion? Literally, what are these words? I don't know what they mean.
Same, bro. Yeah, absolutely. That's where I've been with the thing too. And I'm aggressively indifferent to what's going on about Same. Over there right now. But so there's that element of it. And then I also, I liked, and this is something that I noticed this time around, I like that they are the opposite and they are the foil to Severian, because they are a race of millions and millions and millions of people who act as one. And he's a person with thousands of people inside one body. So it's this opposite thing that I thought was really cool. But the reason why they're so scary to me is that I could see that becoming a real thing. Right. And it's not tin foil. I mean, you look online and you see the slogans and you see people having to speak in approved axioms, basically, and you realize like, hey, that we're not really that far off from that. And I think that one of the things that gets, that has gotten people like the three of us into trouble in the past is that it's not about the substance of what we say. It's about the words that we use to say it. And that has always, like, I'm not built like that. I'm not built because I look at the substance of what people say, which is why I find so much online speech so devoid of any semantic worth at all. But then I get surprised when people get mad at me because I'm like, well, wasn't it clear what I was saying? It's like, yeah, but you said gay or something like that, right? So you used the wrong word.
Yeah, but you said Alex Jones and you didn't follow it up with is a terrible person.
Yeah. right, exactly.
Both David and Kelby have license to say gay and faggot in any context in which they want to say it, by the way.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
Been waiting my whole life to hear those words.
Got my faggot in card.
Yay.
But they're so scary because they're so haggard and they have these empty eyes and they just do, like, they're just like ants. I think one of the things that this lip-tarted tour guy could be talking about too is the fact that they are so disposable. They're all kamikaze fighters. They've been sapped of any individuality to the point where they can see themselves as, but that's a scary thing that could really fucking happen and has really happened in the past. Mm. You know, I mean, if you read history of, you know, Soviet Russia, that was, I mean, people found ways, and there are a lot, like Solzhenitsyn's work is great for seeing how people kept their souls throughout that whole thing. But like, on the surface, you had to act like that, at least. And over generations and generations, you could get the Askians. And they, every time there was an Askian involved, I was just freaked the fuck out. Like, I hate the Askians. I'm glad that they got wiped out with energy weapons in that one scene. That made me happy.
It does feel like that's why I say it's like, it feels very relevant to today, because it's sort of, it's weird though, because you would imagine, you don't get too much background and like where the Askians came from or whatever. You get this sense that this kind of council imposes correct thought on everyone and everyone sort of obeys this. But what we're talking about in terms of like the metaphorical Askians we see today, this is a distributed thing. This just like bubbled up from, you know, people, overly online people, like just spruiking like slogans and correct thought. That was just, it wasn't imposed. It kind of developed and kind of, it's a more distributed form of this, which is even scarier because it makes you feel like this is just an impulse in humanity. And maybe that's something that Gene Wolfe is kind of getting at as well, that this isn't actually some aberration. This is possibly a particular, sort of impulse or compulsion that humanity might have naturally, you know.
It is. And to people who are built different, it's people who prize things like freedom and individuality and artistic expression, it's the scariest thing in the fucking world. But you begin to realize that the whole thing is that it's just more comfortable to be that way. Mm-hmm. I think that there are people who would willingly enslave themselves if it meant that they didn't have to think, especially if it meant that they didn't have to be, you know, like plantation slaves who are working in the heat and who are, you know, a lot of people, I think, would willingly. And if you want to get maybe a little bit hyperbolic about it, kind of have in a way, like they sort of have, as long as they have their phone and their entertainments, they really don't care what happens other than that. They're like, yeah, I'll say the thing. Mm. It's fine. You see it with writers all the time. You know, they're like, give me a book contract. I'll have whatever position I need to have on anything. And which the memo came down about Israel Palestine, apparently. Apparently, it's all pro-Palestine with them. I do know that that is how writers feel about it right now.
Oh, like, yeah, writers, selling your soul for 2K, if that.
Right? Oh, man. I've never been able. It's the gayest fucking artistic realm in existence. The writer's sphere. Fucking Jesus Christ.
If you read Adam's stuff, though, art world is pretty bad, too.
Yes.
Oh yeah, yeah. It sounds like, I don't know. I don't get it. I don't get it. How you can like be in a world where you're supposed to be like about expression and like creation, and you're like, my biggest enemy is anything that is against complete and total freedom to say and do and create whatever the fuck I want. No compromise. It's like, well, babies in China will be dropped out of cargo planes. I'm like, I don't know those babies. Like I say whatever.
No Chinese baby ever called me Wigger.
Oh, I don't know. I can't. I just can't. What do you do? You willingly become an Askian. And then that's your life. Like, why do you want to live. I don't even get it.
Yeah, it is. It is bizarre too that like the ASCIANs today, you know, these people who are extremely, even people who aren't extremely online, just people who are, you know, there's a difference between extremely online and people who are online a lot. Like extremely online is like investment in being online, but there's everyone's basically online a lot in the sense of just scrolling TikTok constantly or Instagram or whatever. But, and people just imbibe this stuff, but you kind of, but at the same time, it's all about individuality. Like, you know, it's about your likes, your profile, all of this stuff. But no one is an individual. That's the weirdest contradiction at the heart of it. Like that it's like modern society is all about you as an individual, yourself, self-care, all that sort of shit. It's all about your autonomy and any like any kind of restriction on that is like complete oppression. But at the same time, none of these people are individuals. Like they're constantly like talking
about. I would just substitute individual for consumer. I have that Fight Club Gen X like anti-consumerist streak in me, hardcore. Mm-hmm. And I think that anything that gets in the way of you being the perfect consumer is what is frowned upon, right? Because mm-hmm. all these identities come along with, you know, value packs that you can buy to be more your individual self, you know what I mean?
The starter kit, right? They got all those memes, like the golf dad starter kit, the like 90s kid starter kit. Yeah, it's all that's the branding that they're trying to push. They're like, identify as this, and we've got all the shit you need right over here. We have an aisle for you.
Yeah, because you see people get enraged about sports teams, which has always thrown me for a loop because I've never given that much of a shit. And I've seen in my days as a nerd, I've seen people get severely heated over like Star Wars and shit like that. And it's all fighting about, you know, you've picked your army of your favorite consumer brand. And then these geniuses, these marketing alchemists who are like, you, if you read marketing books, like these are smart motherfuckers. They've destroyed the world, but they're smart as shit. They realize like, oh, we don't have to get them to fight about Star Wars or the Strohs or whatever. We can get them to fight about who they actually are. As, yeah, that's what I was thinking.
We can get them to see the shirt or is that just a weird sink?
No. Yeah. But like we can get them to fight about like their race or their gender or whatever. And by the way, we have very expensive things that you can do to yourself that we can sell to you to make you more yourself. As a cyberpunk fan, I want like the cool gorilla arms. Like that part of it would be really cool to me. I'd be totally on board. But we're like in the proto cyberpunk point that's lame and stupid, where it's like, you know, we can make you more like who you feel like on the inside.
I always feel like the cyberpunk future that we're actually in is the future imagined at the start of Ubik with, I talked about this with Ryan about like where he's like trying to put the coin in to let his door to open so we can go to work. And the door's like, I'm sorry, that's not the right. Like,
yeah, it's totally that. It's and that. I think that's why I love Cyberpunk so much, the game, the 2077 game, because it's like, if we're going to live in this world anyway, my fantasy is that we at least live in one that's like extremely colorful and hyper violent, where you get to be a genetically modified freak who's really good at killing. That would be really cool to me. But instead, I have a mortgage. You know what I mean? And not just a mortgage, but I have to pay for like, and cyberpunk comments on all this stuff too, right? About like, you know, Edgerunners totally ripped the beginning of Ubik because it has the put the coin in to get into your apartment type thing. We have all that, but we don't have like we don't have like mantis blades that come out of our arms and the ability to jump really high. Okay. So once they get that part, I'll fall right into line.
You'll say the sentences, the correct thought.
I will say the sentences. I will say the will of the people is only valid if the people have the will.
Yeah, that's right.
The fuck they say.
Yeah. So, in terms of what happens in this one, I actually, when I started reading this, I kind of forgot where we left off. Like, where is he at the end of Sword of the Lictor? Do we remember? Is he still in the mountains?
He broke the claw. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's up in the mountains.
No,
or whatever.
No. I don't think, wait, is he, wait, I didn't, if you know, then, cause the last thing I remember is the fight with Bald Anders breaking the sword. The claw break. He goes back to. He's in the mountains still. After that,
I thought that was in the mountains. Was it not?
No, because he comes down. He's with the boat people, right? He's on Lake Diaturna.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still in the mountains, or am I tripping?
That he goes. That's before he goes to the castle. The castle's before that, and then after that, I can't actually remember. But it doesn't really matter. It starts out. He's sort of like in the start of this volume. He's kind of like wandering around. And I think the starting point for this one is he finds the dead soldier and like revives him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then makes his way to the Pelerines. And for most of the first half of the book, he's just, I think someone mentioned this before, he's just like in the sick room recovering, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the Pelerines send him on a quest to go, like, get this anchorite, this hermit, who lives in the mountains, and bring him back. He tries to do that, but then the guy disappears, which is pretty funny. I'm just trying to do, like, broad brushstrokes because a lot kind of happens. It's weird, this one, because a lot happens, but not a lot happens compared to the other
volumes. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Bro. Yeah. When I was reading it, especially in the first half, kind of after the battles take place, there's a whole lot to chew. I mean, there may be more to talk about in the latter half after you give it a week to kind of marinate, like, to be like, what the fuck? But the first half, I was thinking, oh, shit, damn. Just, like, bars that were dropped, kind of, like, the relation of soldiers to slaves, the storytelling aspect of it, where, like, just the bizarreness of it. Like, shit happens. This has always been something I've struggled to explain to people, like, the type of stories that I fuck with, because we know a lot of people who write really weird shit, like it's like can y'all have a plot? And this is one of those things where it's like there's shit happening and it's really random and weird, but it doesn't feel like he's padding anything out. Like it has this real, the story is being told to you. It's not just he's gonna fuck around with this soldier for a few hundred pages, go, I don't know what I'm doing. That was some of my favorite shit in the whole series, was him with the soldier. It was just this bizarre, like, I don't know, like almost Jesus and Lazarus type shit, where it's just like,
like somehow became a reincarnation of Jonas somehow. Mm-hmm.
His robot friend.
Okay, yeah, that shit. So does that mean, is the implication there that like this dude's like a robot or like the soldier?
No, it was like Jonas, the claw made it so that Jonas's consciousness somehow inhabited him the way that Alzabo works, but without Alzabo. He's like, the whole thing about the claw is that Uncle Gene never explains how it works at all. Like nobody knows how the claw works. But yeah, so he's,
other than it's some form of time travel, like it twists time. Like that's how it heals the sick, or like, you know, it brings people to a point when they're not sick or not dead or whatever. But that's the only clear thing we kind of get out of it. But
with the whole Jonas thing. Fuck, I forgot. Never mind.
Sorry, that was my fault for interrupting.
No, it's fine.
The claw is really interesting, and I think we will talk about that a bit later. But yeah, basically comes across this guy who he decides is the reincarnation of Jonas. In that first half, yeah, it's all to do with the Pellerines, who we've talked about before. And then the second half is Severian coming into his own as the Autarch. So the Autarch, who he has met before, I think that was in, was that in Claw or Sword? I can't remember when he met the Autarch.
It was the spy, right?
Yeah.
Well, that he met him also in the House of Zor in Shadow of the Torturer.
That's right. That yes. Yeah.
And then he met him in Father Inir's Hall of Mirrors in Claw.
Yeah.
I want to say that was in Claw.
Well, and technically, he met him thousands and thousands of times.
Mm.
Right.
Well, so yeah, he basically what happens is he, in the end, he's there's a lot happening. I'm going to just go over it very quickly, but he ends up taking up his place as the Autarch because this Autarch dies and he like consumes his frontal lobe with the Alzavo thing again, which was really so cool. Gross. I liked his little, his cute little girly knife to like scoop the brain out to.
That it was all, it was a little, it was, I got the impression that the Autarch was a little gay and their interactions were a little.
Yeah, he's androgynous.
Oh, right.
Because he failed the test that, what's his name is gonna that Severian's gonna take in
yeah,
the end.
Yeah, that's right. They cut your dick off if you don't do what you're supposed to do. Yes.
Which is what that, another right? little nod to, you know, modernity as we know.
Mm-hmm.
It.
Mm-hmm.
Yo, facts, bars.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're a man who wants to lead, you have to lose your cock and balls, basically, is what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so that happens, and then he gets all of the voices and like personalities and stuff that the Autarch has. And then after that, a lot of the other stuff happens, which we'll talk about, but he returns to the Citadel. Is it called the Citadel? The Tower of the Torturers?
The Matachin Tower.
That's right. Yeah. Goes back to Nessus and revisits some of his pals and then works out one of the thing that I found really fun at the end was working out that the it goes back to the Atrium of Time, which we only really see at the in the first one in Shadow of the Torturer, and also visits his own tomb essentially. Again, this like time twisting stuff that maybe has something to do with the Claw, maybe something to do with him himself. And then he kind of finishes up his narrative by saying he's not on his way straight after the book, but he will be doing this like test to see if he is the bringer of the new sun, which is basically bringing back the sun to to its former glory or power or whatever, right? That's sort of very
quick. That's all still very unclear to me. exactly what's going on there. But yes. But now I have a question for the two of you, and it's moving into total speculation and outside the purview of the book itself. But do you think that Uncle Gene got halfway through Citadel and was like, fuck, I got to figure out a way to wrap this shit up? He did it brilliantly, right? I'm not saying that it's shitty or rushed or anything like that, but there is a kind of feeling of like, all right, now I got to get this stuff going. And I will add a slight, twist to that, which is that he also still takes his time with what he's talking about. So again, it's not like, and then this, and then this, and then this. But at the same time, it's kind of, and then this, and then this, and then this.
Mm. I was thinking about this recently, actually, having recently finished a book. Like, do you get the thing when you're at the end of a book where you're like, it's not a, when you're writing it, it's not that you're like sick of it, but it's more like, let's wrap it up quickly, because you don't, because otherwise what ends up happening is if you come to the last like little segment of it, I think you dilute the power of the ending if you just like if you do the whole Lord of the Rings movie with like six fucking different endings, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think a lot of books can feel like, oh, that ended kind of abruptly or that was rushed. It's not, but it's not that they were actually rushed. It's more that you can sense that, not that the writer's getting impatient, but that they actually do need to wrap it up somehow. Like, mm-hmm. and there's a way to do that that's more satisfying or less satisfying or whatever. But in most cases, unless it's like this long, drawn out, epic sort of thing, it will feel a little bit abrupt because it has to end, you know? And you can take your time during the story, but I don't think you can take your time at the end of the story, if that makes sense. Do you get what I mean about that feeling when you're at the end?
Yeah. It's like when you bust and then you like, you try to keep going and it doesn't, you know, it just feels less and less like you just want it to be, and then, you don't want it to be like, okay, I guess.
Like you don't want it to be over, but you can't take it anymore.
yeah. Exactly. That's like, Lord of the Rings is the version of that that's just like, wow, like did you pop a Molly or something? Like,
yeah, just keeps going. Everybody's dead, but the woman's dead, but he's still going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, I know what you mean. I think I always know the ending. At least before I get there, if not before I even start writing. So it's kind of I know the punchline. And then by the time I get there, it's just a matter of how do I make it hit. Like, so, but I do know what you mean in terms of like what you want to avoid when you're at that point. You don't want it to be. And he doesn't. I think, to answer David's question, I think that it's a symptom of it just being the end. Because this is kind of how Gene has been through all four books. Like it's things get delivered and dropped within paragraphs or like even a couple of sentences. You go, oh, that was that one character. Huh. I didn't realize that. And okay, yeah, so moving on from that, I think all of this is just a symptom of it being the end of the story now. So, like, it's kind of been how he's the rhythm. Even the way it's broken up, almost all of these start with, like, so he's just wandering the city. He's just explaining the prison system. He's just, oh, and now we're getting into the good shit. And then with this one, it's like, okay, he's just, like, he jacks this soldier's shit and then decides, I'll bring him back to life since I stole all his shit. And then they're just telling stories and they're sick. And now we're getting into the war and now he's the autarch. And, you know, it's kind of been the rhythm of the whole thing. It feels like.
Yeah.
What makes you ask that question?
Oh, just because I go back and forth because the way that the battle happens feels really fast to me. The way that his transition from Severian at / Thecla to Autarch / thousands of people, that seems quick to me. But then what's really interesting once you get towards the end, I mean, there is a, and you know, I love Uncle Gene, but I'm not going to mince words, a brutal paragraph or two about like the Sumra, the ship that he's on. And that to me seems very deliberately paced. And I think because he's such a good writer, I think that's how he mitigates the feeling that things could be moving a little bit too fast. Now, when it comes to things that I've written, like the last book that I finished, which as we're having this conversation, I realize I need to put that out because it's just sitting there. But when I got to the end of that, I thought you kind of do this thing in your head where you're like, I probably got about 10,000 more words to go. Right. And you're cool with that. That's fine. That's a very reasonable amount. And then it's done in like four, but it's just done. It's just finished. And I think that what that says to me about the Book of the New Sun and about most books, and what I've been trying to explain to my students who don't like ambiguity in endings at all, is that it's not about the end. Like, the book is not about the ending. The book is, if there was ever a book that was about the journey, it's the Book of the New Sun.
Yeah.
Right. So he has to become the Autarch, and he has to do weird space time shit. And things do have to be wrapped up, sure. But if you haven't gotten it by now that it kind of doesn't matter, then you miss the whole point of the book, which I wouldn't say I fully missed it. Exactly. I don't think that I missed it completely the first time around, but I was definitely a plot boy first time. And I think I've grown as a person since then, which you two will be happy.
Now you like the play.
Still don't like the play. Not the biggest play fan, but I like that the Book of the New Sun to me feels like a living thing. It feels organic, you know. There's the word postmodernism has been beat to death, but I think it is that. I think in the notes from Uncle Gene at the back of the book, the fact that I love that he just see, because when I read it and he gets to the what's the word again? Starts with an A. The guy who lives in the ice palace.
Anchorite.
Thank you. Mm. When he gets to that, I thought that that was going to be the mechanism that Gene got the manuscript from, because, you know, because he is, there's this great part when he visits the anchorite. I love weird geometry stuff.
Mm.
I suck at it, but I think it's cool. And so this house, you can't get to this house unless you follow a very specific path. Otherwise you won't be able to see it. And once he finally gets to it, he has a conversation with this guy, and he does eventually kidnap him. And the guy's like, look, I'm from the future. And the reason why I can exist in the past right now is because the past, like your past is true for me, but I don't know if like I'm in your future. Right. So if you take me out of this, I might disappear back to the future style. And he does. But I thought that was going to be the mechanism for sending the book back in time, like the cloud castle, the ice castle. But at the end, it's just like, I'm putting this in a big thing of lead and I'm sending it back in time. And I was like, fuck yeah, let's go. Cool. That works, buddy. You did it.
Yeah. That's that nuts on the table shit, where it's like you have this mechanism right here and you've been writing all this shit. You know you do too, but you're just like, nah.
Nah, it's in lead. It's in lead and he sends it back. But no, I'm right now, probably just because of the day job and stuff like that, I've been thinking a lot about endings and how important they are and how mad people get about endings in general. And to me, it feels very Western. It does feel very Western to me to be concerned with the outcome, the goal, the endpoint. Whereas, you know, doing 115 episodes of a Japanese themed podcast that for the most part has engaged with Japanese media, you start to care about those things less and less, I think, because they have a different storytelling method. It's called Kisho Tenketsu. So it's less of the rising action climax and then falling action. It's more like things sort of happen.
Well, that's most anime episodes. Like they don't have like the rising action, falling action. It's just like,
yeah, it's Miyazaki movies. It's it's Spirited Away, Kiki's Delivery Service. It's why J horror is so scary, because things just happen. Like The Grudge. Mm-hmm. If you've ever watched the original Ju-on, it's like almost a short film series, right? There's like six segments in it, and it's just people getting pursued by a monster and killed, or a ghost and killed. That's it. Mm. Things just sort of happen, and you either enjoy the act of watching those things happen or you don't. But like, yeah, we are all invested in payoff, which I think is weird.
And that's the cyclic nature of it as well, because something like The Ring, right? Like the story of the ring is that there's that terror that you have until you like do the tape, right? And then that just continues going on and on and on. And that's why there's so many sequels. And there's various other examples of this, which is, you know, the same thing is repeated or a similar thing is repeated over and over again. And this is a little bit like he goes into that a little bit in this book with all the stories. Like you were saying before, this is a story about stories. I think that's one of the best ways to read this. It's very obvious, obviously, like, because he throws in different stories, but it actually, I forget which part it's in. I think I marked it down. When that is kind of addressed, I can't remember by whom though.
I might have this same thing marked actually.
Yeah. But I wanted to bring in, have you guys ever read, or you've probably heard the quote from Joan Didion, like, we tell our stories in order to live.
Mm-hmm.
You know that, that quote? It's from the White Album, I think, the essay she wrote. But I almost think that Gene Wolfe and people perhaps who kind of vibe with him like us probably think the opposite, which is that we live in order to tell stories. Like,
yeah.
And I think that's not, that's just not like just a cute inversion of that. Like, I literally think that's one of our drives.
I think fucking, so too. I think
fucking so too. And telling stories.
Absolutely. That's all I care could not agree with you.
Those are the two things that I live for. Yeah.
I have the quote. This is from the Just Man chapter. It's after the Askian story.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes, I have no way of knowing whether you, who eventually will read this record, like stories or not.
Mm.
If you do not, no doubt you have turned these pages without attention. I confess that I love them. Indeed, it often seems to me that all of the good things in the world, the only ones humanity can claim for itself, are stories and music. The rest, mercy, beauty, sleep, clean water, and hot food, as the Askian would have said, are all the work of the Increate. Thus, stories are small things indeed in the scheme of the universe, but it is hard not to love best what is our own. Hard for me, at least.
Yes.
I was like, dude, bars. Yes, absolutely. It's because that's what humans do. That's almost one of the only unique things that we do outside of our, you know, more animalistic stuff.
Yeah, but all the animals do that. So it's like, yeah, that's the one thing I think we have that, you know, we have language, but language is telling stories, really. Like, it's not just bare communication. Like,
Oh, and you see it too when they're telling their stories, because for listeners, these guys, one of them's a big Viking dude. And the other, I forget what the other guy is like, but they're telling stories to win a girl, right? Like, whoever can tell me the best story will be my suitor kind of thing. And I love that they go after each other for like their motives about telling the story. It's like, you told that story so that she knew that you had land and you knew that she knows that you're strong and blah, 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 blah. Because that to me felt like a great commentary about how some people review books, which is they do this thing where they're a psychic and they know the secret heart of the author and what they really meant by it, rather than using stories as a generative jumping off point for their own beliefs. But yeah, no, I just thought like, it's such an, this whole book is such an interesting just look into the various reasons why we tell stories. Cause there are people, by the way, who think like there are theories about this book because we know that he ends up being 1,000 people. There are theories about like how much of this is actually Severian, right? How much of it is his history and how much of it is him kind of losing himself in the music, the moment and owning it and never letting it go. That's just an 8 Mile reference. That's neither here nor there, but but it is like, you know, all these crazy things happen to this one person. And so how much of that is him, but I don't know. Yeah. I think, do you guys have a favorite digressive story from the whole book series?
I liked the which one was it? The Viking guy ones. That one was fun because it gave me
the
like
two
this,
sealers.
Yeah, it gave me this like Nordic. Like I felt like I was in Skyrim or something. Like it was it was such a weird digression, like from the rest of the atmosphere of the story. So that was my favorite in the sense of like giving me something new, you know. Like he always gives you something new, Uncle Gene, which is really good. That was probably my favorite. Yeah, what about you guys?
I really do like the introduction of his role as the Lictor. Like I was just cracking up all the way through it because it dragged on so long. The way David was talking about how it drove him crazy or it was like boring and shit. It cracked me up because I felt the same way, but I thought like, for real? Like, god damn, bro.
Let me tell you about the Vincula.
Yes. I was just like, and it's still bars. Like, it's still just aesthetically, it's like really, just really great writing.
Vincula would be a very beautiful girl's name.
I think so too. I think my favorite story is in Sword of the Lictor. It's about the guy who makes his own son. I'm forgetting the details of it exactly, but I remember really liking that one. It's been a month, so I've slept multiple times since then. But there's a story in there that I really like.
The whole shit regarding the Green Man initially. And the lead up to it, the sort of like the kid in the hut and like all that shit. That was some of my favorite digressive. But I guess if you could call it digressive, it's almost like which parts are digressions whenever it's
because so much of it is like Severian will be like chopping off heads and then like wondering about the nature of the universe or something like that. And that's a direct digression, really. Like,
I loved when he said, I'm not a philosopher, never have been, and don't even consider myself a very smart man. It's like, you've been philosophizing this like for four books now, bro.
What I like is how he'll just randomly drop bars like, you know, he'll be talking about the nature of time, and then he'll just be like, and as we know, men have hundreds more positive qualities than women, but women do have some nice things about them.
But the battle, like in the battle scene, there's one sentence about this chick's titties bouncing, riding down into the, it's like, okay.
All right. He also talks about her milky thighs too. Mm. He's like the swollen milky thighs. This book was much less horny than the first one, or than the third one. I mean,
it's horny in like a different way though. One of the things that's really interesting about this is, and this is from, I think it's from the second book on, you know, when he's got Thecla within him, right? So he's got this kind of anima and animus, right? Like he's got the Thecla being this anima, like the female side of him, because he was raised in a male kind of brotherhood society. There aren't any female torturers, as we know, because they're too cruel. So he not only like, you know, he loves this woman, but like she becomes part of him. And he's also super horny, like, and super horny young man, but he's got this like female spirit within him. And then there's like this suggestion that that's going to help him when he becomes Ortak because what is the punishment for not kind of living up to that kind of new sun test, right? It's being castrated, losing your manhood. That's how they express it too. It's always said you get your manhood cut off, not like you'll be castrated or whatever. So there's some weird gender sex thing going on there, but it's more spiritual. It's not like it's not externalized and in that kind of more horny way in the previous books. But yeah, he's getting at like the divine feminine, the divine masculine, I think, in a little bit more metaphysical way.
Do you feel like this is like a conservative book?
The problem with that and the problem with a lot of what people bring a lot of stuff to Gene Wolfe based on his biography, right? They do that with the Askians. It's like the Askians are the Koreans or the Chinese from the Korean War. And all the Christian symbolism, they view it. Oh, this is just a new version of the Christ story, which, by the way, it's really not. It's just,
it's not at all.
It has
horrible reading of this.
It has some like Christian imagery, like Terminus S could be considered, because the big fucking cross shaped,
it's like
sword.
A cross. Yeah.
But like, yeah. But other than that, it's not really, you know,
he almost
and,
subverts that too in the way that like he loses Terminus Est so early in the story. And that seems like Guts losing his big ass dragon slayer that you think, okay, so where's it going to come back? And it doesn't.
You're it got smashed by a giant with a hammer, with an energy hammer.
But this is the thing, like no one would do that reading if they knew nothing about Gene Wolfe. But because Gene Wolfe is a self-identified conservative and a Catholic, people like to read this stuff into it, which is like, I don't know. It's, it feels a little bit. There's not really any. There is some there in the sense of like he's clearly using certain imagery, and some of the philosophy is obviously derived from, you know, some Catholic thought, but not really. Like, it's just that's his influences. It's like saying, I don't know, is this modern writer conservative because they were influenced by fucking T.S. Eliot or Cormac McCarthy or something like that? Just
what is what would qualify to you as like a conservative novel?
Well, I mean,
or is that a stupid way to think about it, about books?
Well, it's I think stupid or not stupid. It's just a way to think about it, but Cormac McCarthy's a good example. Like Blood Meridian, I think in some senses you could read as a conservative novel because it's taking that that idea of the conservative outlook being like it's the Hobbesian view, you know, life being what is it, brutal, short, something like that, you know, all against all sort of stuff, and you need institutions and, you know, society and certain amounts of conformity and religion and all of this stuff to tame the unhinged wild impulses that are in humanity. You could say that's conservative, but it's not conservative in the sense that, you know, conservatives don't really like violence that much in their media portrayals, but that's a very violent book. But yeah, you could read that as conservative if you wanted to.
Got a couple of conservative. I'm teaching Call of Cthulhu for Halloween, and I've had some students who have opted out because Cthulhu looks too demonic. And I was just like, all right, bye. See ya. Go do something else, I guess, because we're talking about this cool book. But yeah, I totally get that. I was it occurred to me as I was asking you the question that it could be a stupid question because it's 2023 and those words don't really, they don't mean that much, I think, as much as they would in 1982 when he was writing this. And they become so kind of charged by other types of media that we have immediate associations that we make when you say conservative or progressive. It is funny though that he consistently refers to the Askians as progressive. He uses that word that they're progressives. That's what made me think of it. It's like, oh, okay. I see what you're doing, dude. But I like that. I like writers to be conservative. I hope we have a renaissance of more conservative minded authors just to get something a little different. You know,
well, it's also kind of like an oxymoron because a lot of conservatism, a lot of conservatist ideals don't really value any kind of deep connection with any kind of like expressive thought or, you know, so like that's a little too gay, which is not also not really something that conservatism fucks with. And so like, it's yeah, Book of the New Sun is a bit too gay to be conservative. Do y'all ever think about that shit, like worry, or whether worry or not, like, do you ever, does interpretation ever affect what you're doing, like how somebody's going to perceive something that you're writing? Like, does that ever affect your direction with it?
Not me, but there are, it is a thing now. Like, people who are younger, like, really, it really worries them. I don't know if it was on this episode or if it, we recorded it or not, but I had to go and give a talk at a, like, my friend runs this creative writing class at this university here, and I had to go and give this talk on an essay I wrote. And then, so it was a very brief presentation, and then I would kind of talk about the project, how I came up with it and shit like that, right? Just to give you a bit of insight as to how you do it. But at the same time, they did this thing where, like, they also had other students doing the same thing. So it was a sort of way to sort of, I don't know, make the students feel like they were on the same level with people in the industry or some shit like that. I don't know I don't know what the pedagogical reason was for it. But so there was a student who presented a really great excerpt of a novel that he was writing. And it was sort of like about abalone farmers in Tasmania, and really beautiful. Like, it's literally one of the best pieces of student writing I've ever experienced, right? Really good. And so the story that he kind of explained was that it's basically about abalone farmers, and this guy, like, moves down to Tasmania. He's got a bit of a murky past. He gets runs with these guys who kind of radicalize him. And the ideology is left, he says this in the presentation, that the ideology is left sort of ambiguous. So it's not, you don't know, it might be neo-Nazi, it might be something else or whatever. The questions that he got from his classmates were, in my opinion, absolutely outrageous, like, as fellow creatives, because, like, they made no commentary or questions about his wonderful writing. All they were worried about was, what if someone reads this and becomes radicalized from it by your depiction of radicalization? And I'm just like, what is going on? Like, yeah, that's not his responsibility. I'm sorry.
No, it's not his responsibility. And personally, I'm at my bravest when I'm writing.
Yes. I'll write anything, and you should be. Yeah.
You know, but I think that I've noticed the same things that you have, because a fun thing that I do with my class is we'll read a book, like, for example, The Crucible. And after we're done reading it, we'll spend 10 minutes in class going to its Goodreads page and reading all the one star of The Crucible and just seeing, like, what people say about it. And you can't get away from this book talk nonsense. You know what I mean? Like, the way that these people talk about books is insane to me. It's insane to me. Like, I saw a recent book talk thing about, like, it was just straight up, it was like a hashtag, and I can't remember exactly what the hashtag was, but it was essentially like, get white men out of fiction or something. And they were giving all these examples of white dudes who wrote bad shit or whatever, which we do sometimes. That's fair, but everybody does. So, like, that kind of, okay, so I did an episode of Agitator recently with David Simmons where we talked about Whalefall. And
that was really funny, that episode, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So
it was really good.
Long story short, it's a book about a scuba diver who has a lot of issues with his dad. His dad dies. He goes to try to find his dad's suicided body in the ocean, gets swallowed by a whale, and has to try to escape. It's fantastic. It's a really great book. Beautiful writing. And we talked on the show about how, you know, one of the major criticisms when you look at the book talk Goodreads thing is, like, this is about a man with daddy issues. And it's like, yeah, But you can't just say what the book is in a derisive tone and have that be your entire criticism of it. Like that doesn't make sense. So there's, on the one hand, there are these people who are really afraid of content, and they're essentially, you have just become the new, Christian conservatives of my youth. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. If you really think that like art shouldn't exist because what if a crazy person reads it? And that's what Tipper Gore was saying about NWA in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So to me, you are the enemy. There's no question, no quarter, nothing for you, right? But then on the other end, there's like this this real desire to not see anything from certain perspectives, and it doesn't matter what they're saying. So it's like a two-pronged battle that we're fighting. But I think in the end, we'll win.
Honestly, I do not think that question would have come up if the main characters weren't white men. Like if it was some other group and they were radicalized in like very similar like circumstances, it wouldn't have been a question. No way.
Yeah, if they were brown though, it might have been like, do you have an issue as a white man writing about this? Like, we're not allowed to do anything right now. Like, there's nothing we can do where people are like, that's great. And for a while, the gays had a pass, but not anymore.
No, not like, anymore.
That's why I feel such strong solidarity, and why like so much of the agitator sphere, I think, is gay. Why we're like honorary gays is because we're in the same boat. It's like everybody hates our guts.
The people who buy books in this kind of like weird fanatical, I freaking love science, gotta have my coffee type of way, those people don't like us. And it sucks because they do move books. I'm not going to lie and say like they have no influence at all. It would be great if some of these influencers liked white men, but they don't. But the rest of like normal people do. You just never hear from them because they're normal and they're busy doing shit. Mm, and they see a book like Whale Fall and they're like, that looks cool. And then they read it and they're like, that was cool. Mm-hmm. And then they move about their day.
Mercy is my newest and my best-selling book, and it has like 26 reviews on Goodreads. It's like,
yep,
they don't talk about it.
Yeah. No. Yep, it's a problem, but I just like it when people read the stuff, you know? And it would help. See, that's why there has to be somebody, and I think Matt could, I mean, it could be us, could be all of us, could be Glenn, but like this kind of non-ideological sphere of book lovers, I think could be a really good thing, because my hunch is that there are a ton of quiet people right now who don't know about us, and we obviously don't know about them, but they're quiet, who really just love books and want to go back to a world where you can talk about them. Like we're talking about this book right now before I introduced my stupid, is this book conservative question, who can just talk about books and writing without either stepping on eggshells or being kind of vitriolically aggressive about how this book or that book doesn't fit your, but it doesn't check your boxes. You know, it's like an angry Yelp review about how you got bad customer service because the book didn't do what you wanted it to.
Or a 5-star, but you need to understand the historical context of Book of the New Sun to appreciate it as an important piece within the blah blah. Shut up. It's
instead of like
masterpiece.
This book is a masterpiece, and it's one of the best books ever written.
Yeah, it's so good. And so few people know about it, other than like, you know, it's kind of wasted on science fiction fantasy nerds because they don't really know how great it is. Like they love it because of all the, you know, the phantasmagoria or whatever, which is great, but like there's so much more here. Like that the character of Severian alone is like worth the price of admission, because it's like you never get a character like this in these sorts of books. You never get someone with this kind of what's the word I'm or phrase I'm looking for, like psychological depth, you know, in a in a genre piece. And usually that's by design, because most genre pieces, it's all about plot and formula and moving things along, and that's great. And you don't really have much time for psychological depth because it's all about action. But this one, like, manages to do both. Like I said, heaps of shit happens in it, but we also have digressions. We also have, we really get to know this guy, and yeah, he's very real, like, which is a bizarre thing to say for someone who's, a bare-chested torturer traipsing through a far future world, but he is. He's a real guy, and you just don't get that. Like, you're not going to get that in Conan stories or something like that. But it's clearly drawing from that kind of genre, you know.
Yeah, Severian's more like Schwarzenegger when the cameras stop rolling
and having when a stogie.
Anything I vision becomes real. This brings up, and
I forget nothing.
I know I keep digressing, but this is such an interesting question to me, because you mentioned the plot fantasy nerds, the Brandon Sanderson people who are fanatics, total fanatics. When we think about genres that are popular right now, it is these books that appeal to autists, maybe people who are very concerned with tropes, plots, and making sure that their books do very specific things in very specific ways. And I think that's true in fantasy and romance, which are the two biggest genres, sci-fi also. But then I look back, because I've been doing a lot of I'm doing a book called Only Forward. I'm recording with Jay tomorrow about that. It's a cyberpunk book, and it's really interesting. It's got magical realism in it. And the 80s and 90s seem to have this real renaissance, especially when it comes to cyberpunk books, for just having a lot of weird shit in them. We're all weird shit lovers. And I was thinking about this, and I don't want to sound too negative because I have a mostly positive outlook on things. But like, when the people who buy books are autists who want very specific things to happen, whether that's in terms of the appropriateness of the content or just simply following tropes, how do you get people who don't care about, like, people who are more like us but don't read? How do you get them to read? Because I think most of them are music nerds. If I had to guess, I don't think they're gamers. I think gamers are more the Sanderson people. We're talking about, like, people who've mostly like spend most of their time listening to records. So, like, how do you, and I'm saying this for my own personal benefit when I talk to these people, like, how do you get people to fucking read?
You go to artisan markets and rap shows to promote your books.
Yeah, you got to be a marketer. Like, I think, like, you can't just be an author. Like, that's something that I kind of realized over the last year, is that, and you guys have actually taught me, is that you do, however you publish your book, you have to, like, learn the marketing skills as well. Like, learn how to sell. Like, I'm already thinking about, like, how to sell this book, you know, and I haven't even got a contract yet. But, like, I think it's just a skill set that you have to develop. But I think one other thing you can do as far as the writing goes is kind of, so are you saying that, like, the music people you're talking about would be into the weird shit, or is that the barrier to entry is just that they're not big readers?
Right. So what I'm saying is that when you have people who are big, gamers, for example, right? Like, they're people who like rules and order, and they naturally gravitate towards a Brandon Sanderson book and they love it, or a lit RPG or something like that. Music people who are like heavy into music, they're not just listening to top 40 shit. They'll listen to like albums that they like music that does weird things. And I think that appreciation, the aesthetic appreciation for like, if you like a band like Death Grips, which is very weird and very hard to get into, but has a lot of value if you put the time in, that's the same mechanism that would get you to like something like the Book of the New Sun.
Mm.
So it's like, but then those people also tend to spend most of their time listening to music. Mm. So it's like, okay, how do I,
you just have to get it in front of them. Like that's the biggest hurdle is trying to get it, because they will fuck with it. I've proven time and time again. I'm the only author. Well, you and me, because Dead Boy too, I've seen on people's show. Like we're the only authors on a lot of music lovers' shelves. And they say that shit too. They're like, I just read you. I haven't read anything since like Goosebumps. But I'll buy all your shit. I'm like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I think you're right. Yeah. It's probably that simple. I overthink these things.
I do think with like singular books itself, I think like a good strategy would be to Trojan horse it a little bit, like make the barrier to entry be really low, like just make it really easy to get into like really kind of crisp writing, short sentences, and then like pull the weird shit out. Like once they've slid in, from that point of view, maybe that's a thing to do. But yeah, it is. It's like the struggle with anything. It's just getting in front of the right people. It is hard.
I do think we need to aggressively push against the autists. I do not want them controlling the market. Instead of catering, it's like, no, y'all don't get this shit. Go write a rule book and cry about it. I don't.
Yeah, they're all the ones who complain about this book, I think. It's like, you know, but wait a minute, what's the magic system?
Magic system? Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, but wonderful. I'm just trying to find some like parts that I really loved, like passages. I might cut out this dead air while I'm looking.
This does get its flowers though a lot, and that makes like, I wonder, like people respect it. There's, you know, people respect Book of the New Sun, hold it in high regard, and I just wonder how the fuck that is, because it seems to be in the like sci-fi fantasy camp of people who really appreciate it. And I'm like, I've tried reading y'all shit and I've never gotten into it. Like Book of the New Sun is the only fantasy shit I've really fucked with that I can even think of at all. So how, like,
it's just undeniable, I think, is the thing. I think you can't read it and not have part. Like if we're doing passages, by the way, I have passages because there's a lot of cool shit. Did you have one, Matt?
I'm looking at the moment. I'm probably going to cut the dead air of
me. Yeah,
no
worries.
But there's
a bit. Yeah, there's a bit where he's dreaming towards the beginning. It's in the chapter called Fever. And I remember I was reading this in my garage as I do, and I was just going like, ooh. So he's basically he sees a carafe with Hethor in it in his dream. And this is Hethor speaking. I think I remember this correctly, but it goes like this. I heard his voice as one might hear the squeaking of mice. Sometimes driven aground by the photon storms, by the swirling of galaxies, clockwise and counterclockwise, ticking with light down the dark sea corridors lined with our silver sails, our demon-haunted mirror sails, our 100-league masts as fine as threads, as fine as silver needles sewing the threads of starlight, embroidering the stars on black velvet, wet with the winds of time that goes racing by, the bone in her teeth, the spume, the flying spume of time cast up on these beaches where old sailors can no longer keep their bones from the restless, the unwearied universe. Where is she gone? My lady, the maid of my soul. Gone across the running tides of Aquarius, of Pisces, of Aries. Gone. Gone in her little boat, her nipples pressed against the black velvet lid, gone, sailing away forever from the star-washed shores, the dry shoals of the habitable worlds. She is her own. Put out the launch. Sailmaker, make a sail. She has left us behind. We have left her behind. She is in the past we never knew, in the future we will not see. Put out more sail, Captain, for the universe is leaving us behind. God, that shit is just like banger, dude. So, and this is for listeners, this is like, This is in the middle of sword and sorcery shit going on. Mm-hmm. You get stuff like that. Fuck Tolkien.
Yeah. I really, probably the passage I think for me was, and one of the most important is towards the end. This is in Father Aenir's letter, that chapter. And this is where he talks to Rudisund, the advocate of the dead, right? So basically Sverin says to him, "So you are the advocate of the dead." The old man nodded. "I am. People talk about being fair to this one and that one, but nobody I ever heard talks about doing right by them. We take everything they had, which is all right, and spit, most often, on their opinions, which I suppose is all right too. But we ought to remember now and then how much of what we have we got from them. I figure while I'm still here, I ought to put in a word for them." But that little bit where he talks about the dead and how, like, we just take everything from them and just don't really pay them any respect and just forget about them, that links into what we were talking about before, I think, is that's one way you could read a conservative spirit to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That being venerate your ancestors and what came before, and also that links in with the whole idea of stories and stories being the sacred thing, because
totally, yeah. Ooh, dude, you might have really hit it, like, because I've been big into ancestor work, like from a chaos magic perspective. That just made something click in my brain. So it's still, you know, a fetus of a thought, but like the link between stories and ancestors, there's a key there. I think you just dropped a huge key with that. There's, if you want to see how he does philosophy here, this is from the Sand Garden, where he comes across this thorn bush that has all the claws on it. Because it turns out there's just a plant that grows claws.
Yeah.
What struck me on the beach, and it struck me indeed, so that I staggered as at a blow, was that if the eternal principle had rested in that curved thorn I had carried about my neck across so many leagues, and if it now rested in the new thorn, perhaps the same thorn, I had only now put there, then it might rest in anything. And in fact, probably did rest in everything, in every thorn, on every bush, in every drop of water in the sea. The thorn was a sacred claw because all thorns were sacred claws. And the sand in my boots was sacred sand because it came from a beach of sacred sand. The Cenobites treasured up the relics of the Sanyasins because the Sanyasins had approached the Pancreator, but everything had approached and even touched the Pancreator because everything had dropped from his hand. Everything was a relic. All the world was a relic. I drew off my boots that had traveled with me so far and threw them into the waves that I might not walk shod on holy ground. That's like, almost like Buddhist, right?
I was going to say, that's Buddhist? A Buddhist animist shit.
Yeah, animist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, God is everything. This this tie clip and this jade Buddha are the same. This grain of sand and this flake of gold are the same.
Which is why it's such it's such an impoverished idea to be like, oh, this is just a Christian allegory. It's just like, I think the best books, the best movies, the best music, it always is all of these things. You know, like, you can project the Christian allegory if you really want to, but you can also like have a very animist perspective on it, that passage alone. I feel like there's always more going on in a really good book than just the one reading that people have. Like, oh no, it means this, you know, like.
It's like, you're adorable.
Yeah.
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 It means that and.
I love how confusing, I guess, even though, like, that was the other thing I did here before going into this book, was how confusing it is. And I feel like it kind of lessened the blow for me, where I was like, what are y'all talking about? Like, what are you so caught up in and twisted around about? But how it does throw people for loops or whatever, I think helps it in that regard a lot, to be just when people try to come to this being like, it's an allegory for this.
Yeah.
It's like you're going to give a definitive interpretation of Book of the New Sun, the most confusing fantasy book ever written. Like,
people really need to cool it with interpretations. Like, people start reading something and like they'll be in the first chapter and like, what's my interpretation of this? It's just read it, dude. Like, just let it flow through you and over you or whatever. Like, not have like your, okay, here's my take ready to go straight away, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not having takes is a huge, well, it's a take in itself, but it's the most important take, which is to not have them at all.
And also you can't reduce a book like this, which I agree with you, David, this is like one of the best books ever. Like, it's a work of genius. It's a masterpiece. You can't reduce this to fucking mere takes. Like, it's
1,000 pages long.
Yeah. It's not reducible to takes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very few things are, but yeah.
But that's also, I was thinking about this in the car today, and I think that is actually the beauty of podcasts too. I think that once you get to a point like Perfume Nationalist or Agitator, Getting Lit, any of these podcasts, right? You get to a certain let's call it 50 episodes, and it becomes untakeable, mm-hmm. irreducible to a single take. Because at a certain point, after 50 episodes, that means you more than likely have around 100 hours of material. And when that happens, like, you can't say that a podcast is one thing or another. You can't say that you can make a judgment on its quality if you've listened to it. But we've kind of steeled ourselves against petty criticism, because we're like, if somebody says like, well, Agitator, they're just, you know, we get the edgy thing a lot. You know, it's like, yeah, the podcast is called Agitator. They're edgy.
It's like with Adam being somebody, being affiliated with Adam. I'll say being friends with Adam. People, it's bad enough that people are like, he's affiliated or he gives a platform. I'm like, nah, he's my friend, actually. So I'll say it with my chest there. But they'll like get mad about us being friends with Adam. And I'm like, okay, I've listened to hours on hours on hours of System of Systems, have talked for hours to Adam himself. Like, this, you can't, like, you can make that accusation. They throw that accusation around all the time, whether it's Adam or Jack or whatever. And it's like, yeah, y'all haven't. Have you listened to all 200 plus episodes or not? Like, you're not allowed to have an opinion.
And you don't know what you're talking about. The same way, if you haven't read a book, you don't know. And I just remembered through this conversation what the book talk hashtag was. It was about dudes who like Infinite Jest.
Oh, right? God.
And I am one of those dudes. Book of the New Sun, Infinite Jest, and a few others are like in my top five. But for the longest time, Infinite Jest was my favorite book. I thought it was the best thing since, you know, sliced
Mein Kampf
or whatever. The best thing since that. But I basically, the whole idea is that, you know, have you ever been cornered by a dude who's talking about Infinite Jest all the time and how it's, you know, such a slog to have to sit there and listen to them? And I'm like, yeah, it's 1,000-page book. There's a lot to talk about. If that's your thing, then you're going to talk about that for a really long time. Same with the Book of the New Sun, same with different podcasts. But there's like a really interesting kind of derisive way to talk about people who are into things. It's just like these, you know, kind of asexual nerds who are, you know, very focused on this one thing. And it's like, yeah, because it's big and cool. Mm. And there's
always hilarious that you have to be asexual to read a book. That must have taken you 30 years to get through that. 1,000 pages.
You just read a book after sex. Like,
yeah.
That's what I do. But Yeah, the infinite jest thing, like being this complaint of people getting stuck in a corner at a party to some guy going on and on about infinite jest. Once again, I bring up the famous Tyler the Creator tweet. Just walk away. like
how are you gonna be cyberbully?
Yeah, exactly. Like, how are you gonna be like infinite jest mansplained or whatever? Just walk away. Like,
close your eyes.
Give as much as you get. Like, I cannot stand people who complain about like someone mansplaining or being really boring or stuff like that. Just have fun with it. Like, you know, clap back at them. Like, you know, inject your own personality into the conversation. Don't like sit there and then complain about it on Twitter later on, like how some guy talked to you about infinite jest for like an infinite amount of time. You know,
are we not supposed to talk about things that we like? You know,
yeah. Right? Yeah. Those kind of takes always make me sad because I'm like, you just sat there while somebody. What you're saying is you're a terrible conversationalist. Like, you never jumped in with anything. You can derail the conversation if you have something better to talk about. I mean, Jesus.
We could even argue about it. Something else.
Yeah. Be like, I don't like it. But you know what they won't do? They will never argue with the infinite jest autist about infinite jest because that person has read the book.
Yes.
And if you want to argue about why infinite jest is bad, but you have not read the book, the last thing you want to do is talk to somebody who has. Because everybody who I know who's read the book, it might not be their favorite, but they say, yeah, it was amazing. It's great. People who talk shit about this book didn't read it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that people who talk shit about Book of the New Sun, for the most part, if I were to wager a guess, it would be people who put it down after like halfway through Shadow or whatever. They're like, yeah, that book sucks. And people who talk about it, like, it's this crazy projection thing that I'm so sick of, where people, it's where they just call you the thing that you are, but they do it in this tone that's rude. Mm. You know what I mean? Where it's like, you're just like, you're just a guy who's like into smart stuff. And I'm like, well, yeah, when you say it like that, it makes it sound bad. But I mean, yes, I am. Or you're just like a white male. I'm like, yeah, I am. But when you say it like that, sounds like that's a bad thing. Or you're a dude who's into big books like Infinite Jest, and you think that that makes you better than everybody else. And it's like, where did you get, like, what are you projecting onto me? Mm. That this, like, I'm actually a person who is one of the most identity, like, I think about myself probably the least of most people that I know. Seriously, based on how people talk
this
to me,
is true.
Like, I don't think about myself at all.
I have to remind you who you are a whole lot.
Yeah, all the time. All the time. All the time. Sometimes I think that I'm Kelby on the phone, and then I start saying the N-word. It's really weird. But it's just, I don't know. It's a little bit of a rant, but it annoys me so much, this like projection. And it's not even like, it's not even critiques to the point where they're talking about a book like Infinite Jest or Book of the New Sun in an interesting way. They're just using that shitty tone.
Like, and also no one can ever talk about the book itself. It's always about what the book represents. It's like second order observation,
right?
Of what it means to be a reader of this. Well, one, what it means to be a reader in the first place, because not many people read anymore. Well, that's arguable, but like, and people who do say they read usually don't. They just buy Infinite Jest or, like, you know, all the cool books that you should have for your coffee table or your bookshelf or whatever. But it's also about what kind of person you are based on your library. You know, remember a couple of years ago when there was that bookshelf red flags?
Yeah.
Like, yes. There was this whole trend about, like, oh, if you go home and the guy you're going home with has, I don't know, fucking Jordan Peterson or some shit like that, like, or various different, like, authors, like, that's a red flag. It's just like, what?
Yeah, because they read a book?
He reads.
That's the consumer mindset, though. That's like,
it's these, the, yeah.
these yeah. aren't books that I'm interested in reading. These are books that I'm interested in right. displaying. Like that's yes. what that's mm-hmm. that fucked up idea that like it's yeah. not it's not the books themselves. It's like what these mean when they're on my shelves.
Right. And this yeah. is also how these people tell on themselves, the same mm-hmm. way that they're telling on themselves when they say that they think that bad books might influence people. What they're really saying is that they're so weak of mind that they are susceptible to being brainwashed by whatever mm-hmm. they read. And if they are, then everybody else might. And it's like, sweetie, I'm sorry, but I can read something and not immediately make that my entire personality. I know it's crazy. But I have the discernment to be able to do that, right? Which is why I, you know, I can read the Turner Diaries every year on Christmas for fun.
Religiously.
Religiously. And not hold any of its beliefs, but just think that it's a riveting
tale. I just chant it, all right? Like it.
I might know it by heart, but it doesn't affect who I am as a person. But for real, yeah, these people are so, like, they are this way. And I believe this is becoming true of everything that you see on the internet. It kind of seems almost like a playground. I know you are, but what am I type thing. But mm-hmm. when I hear people accusing other people on the internet of doing something, now I just immediately assume that that's how they are as a person. Oh,
definitely.
You know what I mean? Like yeah. if you're like, you're a racist because of like deep down, you're struggling with that right now. Mm-hmm. You're struggling with how you view other races.
Oh, that's all of them. All the yeah. race people. All of them.
Yep.
I've been calling that from the get-go because mm-hmm. I don't know, as a true not racist, absolutely nothing puts me in my place. You can't put me in my place. I'm also not, yeah. I appreciate getting the faggot card from you, but I'm not a homophobe. So you don't get to tell me if I can say faggot or not.
Really?
I'm not homophobe. I'll say whatever I want. Like,
well, that's the thing too.
I would with never presume to like, tell you.
Oh, but people who are like, oh, that's homophobic. Again, you're working through something, right? Mm-hmm. Where as soon as I hear that from like another, you know, ostensibly straight person, right? Where it's like,
yeah, they're probably gay. Like, it's usually not that they're homophobic. They're usually like yeah, gay.
I think it's more that they are actually, I think they might be disgusted by homosexuals is the thing. I think they might actually find it to be like deep down. They get queasy when they think about gay people. And so they project that out onto other people. Because if you really didn't care, for example, I don't, then you can just say whatever. Like I can say the words, you know, two dudes 69ing, and it didn't magically make me gay.
I thought of a great new euphemism for anal sex today.
What's that?
Browning the meat.
The other brown meat.
So good.
Yeah, so good.
So good.
Yeah. Oh, what was I going to say? I had something else to say, but I guess we'll leave that rant there. But yeah, basically, like it used to be the case that an educated person's, not even an educated person, someone who was well-read, had all sorts of books on their bookshelf. There was no such thing as like a red flag like book. It was just, you were just widely read. Like you had, you know, ultra libs on there, and then you had like more conservative writers. Like it wasn't anything that required any kind of commentary. It just meant you read widely.
Yeah, I've had some deep ass conversations with people who have like shelves full of Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah,
it's like
Ann Coulter.
Yeah, it's okay to read stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
it
the motto.
It is okay to read stuff, although it's not okay to read Bill O'Reilly books because they suck. And Ann Coulter sucks too. Like, if you're gonna go conservative, at least do something interesting. You
like
know,
PJ or Rourke or something like that.
What you were saying about this book not being reducible to a strict kind of Christian interpretation, I think is so interesting, because a lot of the best books like Honest to God by John Robinson and stuff like that, like actual Christian apologetics, if the really good ones aren't even reducible to Christianity. Mm, mm. Like they all go off on some like mystic badass semi-animist tangents if they're good, you know? So the Book of the New Sun in particular, like, isn't reducible, but most good things really aren't, because it ties into what you were saying about just being well-read. If you're like, I love Alan Watts and all of his talks about Vedanta and stuff. And that is when I'm in my 40s or 50s or whatever, that's how I want to be. I want to be that well-read and well-versed and all this kind of stuff, where you can just speak extemporaneously on whatever subject and be able to, you know, weave all these stories together in such an interesting way. And if stories, you know, if we live to tell stories, then that really should be the goal. It should be to get really good at being able to make stories off the top of your head and recall them and recite poetry and rap lyrics and quotes from movies and passages from books. And to be like, there aren't any people like that anymore, right? Nobody, you ever notice that? Like when you talk to people, like they don't ever quote, they quote like Twitter bullshit at you, but they don't quote things that they've heard that they thought were interesting. And people used to do that. That used to be a thing where you would like recite something.
They quote correct thought.
Kardashian correct thought. Or Asian. What?
Asian correct said that, thought.
When dumplings said that, are good. Like, come on. I was like, come on, man. But then I thought about it and I'm like, yo, he's right. That is just one letter away from being Asian.
It is. No, like I wasn't even like being coy or whatever.
Maybe the wokey tour person was right. Maybe it is problematic, quote unquote.
Yeah. Book of the New Sun, most problematic book of all time, for sure.
It's still great, even if it is. So, yeah. It's even better now that it's racist.
Now that Matt's like, if I thought I liked it before.
Now that it's yellow periling all over the place.
Let's go. That's so funny. But if you were in a war, I have a lot of sympathy for people who are really racist, but it's because they were in a war, like Vietnam or Korea, or, you know, I'm sure there were feelings about the Germans too, and the Japanese and all that kind of stuff. It's like, well, I feel like if a member of a certain race kills all of your friends, it's okay to be racist for the rest of your life against their entire people. Why not?
Yeah.
Give them a pass.
Even if it's in the way, it's usually like at this point, people who are that age from like, you know, from like World War II to like a Japanese person. They're like, oh, hey, what's up? Yeah, your people killed my friend back in. Like, it's like they could be talking to a 22-year-old, you know? It's like,
this is why I'm just ahead of the curve on hating the Chinese, because we're all going to hate the Chinese in 10 years.
We'll be them.
I'm getting in early. Yeah. Or be them. Yeah. Those are the Askians, dude.
All right. Anything more to say about this book? Do we have?
There's going to be more to say after a while. This one's
you got to let it stew.
You got to let it stew. Yeah. And I'm just really happy to have been a part of this. I'm hyped for anything. Let's crack open Earth. Let's get into
it. Let's do it.
Because. Yeah, no, I've really enjoyed this. It's a masterpiece.
Have you read Earth, David?
Yes. Yeah. Any chance to talk to Matt for 2 hours is a good excuse to read an entire book. So I'm down for whatever. We can have monthly sessions on whatever. But I think that the Book of the New Sun, if you are a writer, I've been talking a lot about readers now, but from a writer's perspective, something like New Sun is what every writer should be trying to do. It's a life's work. And Wolf wrote books after this, but none of them are as monumental as New Sun. And there's a reason for that. And I think that a lot of writers who I've met or who I see online, they are sort of caught up semi through necessity, semi through vanity in trying to become a kind of like a Stephen King, or, you know, kind of like a book signing famous, like, get my shit turned into a movie. You know, like every writer, myself included, I think it would be cool to see a movie of my stuff. But like for most writers, that's their goal. That's their whole, that's their life's work.
Well, you did see a movie of your stuff, but we don't need to go there again.
Man, that's got everybody. Yeah, people love to keep bringing that up. They keep asking me for copies of the book, and I'm like, yo, go.
I gave it away for free on the Discord. Yeah. So if you're an agitator patron, yeah. you can.
Sorry, I shouldn't bring that up if that's raw for you, David. I shouldn't.
No. At this point, I don't really care. His agent hit us up to have a book out on Broken River.
And yeah.
That's
we said no.
Happen. Yeah. Said no.
No.
but instead of having your goal to be this, you know, politically correct, widely loved shit author of mediocre books, what an author's real goal should be is to write something like Infinite Jest or New Sun or something that after you're dead, which both Wallace and Wolf are, people talk about, right? It's building a tower of brilliance that will outlive you. And I get so inspired and so emotional, like thinking about books like this, because they're so powerful and so like just amazing that everybody should read it and everybody should step their fucking game up.
Yeah. Step your pussy up, as we say in the gay community. but the other thing I would add to that would be, I've really come to appreciate the necessity of doing it your way too. Like Gene Wolfe did this entire book his own way. He did it in a way that like no one else had done a story like this before. And it's got him written all over it. It's really individual. He's not trying to like fit into a market. He's not writing, he's not writing his version of a thing. He's writing his story and doing it in a way that he wants to do it. And I think like that is a really obvious point, but it is something that you, from a writer's perspective, you need to get straight in your mind. I think it actually really unlocks it. Like, you know, instead of trying to emulate this person or trying to be the next Stephen King, the next Gene Wolfe or whatever, just lean into your own way of doing things and make it like and own it, you know, and you can tell that he's completely owned the style, what he set out to do, and he achieved it, I think.
Bars. Yeah. 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, boys. It's been great to speak to you for like what, 6+ hours or something like that.
Could have gone 6 more.
Yeah. We will have to do it again. I think we will do Earth, right? We'll do Earth and the New Sun at some point.
Oh, yeah. We got to get you on Agitator, too.
Yeah, give me something Japanese to read or watch. I'll do it.
Oh, that would be fun. Okay, I'll start thinking. There'll be something cool. We should do a stupidly big book for Matt's Agitator episode.
Jesus Christ. All right. Make sure it's an audio book so I can read it.
Or something.
Yeah. Something that's like 800 pages.
Or something like, really perverted. Look, I know some really perverted Japanese stuff that we could watch.
Oh, let's go.
I'm down. Yeah. Perverted stuff's cool too. Mm. Yeah, I'm down. But yeah, for sure. We'll do that.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
Peace.
Disorder! When I became the sun, I shone like the dead.